You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
If everybody had an ocean across the USA, then everybody be serving like California. You'd see them wearing their baggies, Warachi sandals too, a bushy, bushy blonde hairdo, serving USA. You'll catch them surfing at
their side. Yeah, it's going to be... We're all going to be swimming in California today. Joining me is Richard Caruso. Now, Richard, I can't say Richard, it's too formal. Rich, first of all, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Major Mac. You got your water wings on out there?
We're going to need, according to the weather people, and God only knows if they know what they're talking about, but God only knows. So, if they're right, then yeah, an inch an hour here this afternoon, so we'll see.
Wow. Mercifully,
they're wrong most of the time, so, question for you.
Were officers swim clad?
Yeah, we were. Because our parents loved us. They taught us to swim. The question for you now. It's been kind of a topic this morning. So, if an Italian girl tells you that I'm learning how to make the sauce, right, for you,
what does that mean?
What does that mean?
Well, I mean, I have a story that is similar to that. I was dating a Southern girl in Myrtle Beach, and she goes, "I'm going to make you some sauce for your spaghetti." I was all excited, and when I came home from the gym, there were two bottles of Ragu on the counter.
Uh-oh.
And I looked at her. I didn't want to be insulted, but I looked at her. I'm like, "What is this?" And she's like, "I'm making your spaghetti." And if that was my father, old school Italian, I mean, that would have been a very a big time insult. But we say gravy.
You know,
we say gravy. We say sauce. But
okay, so when an Italian girl says, "I'm learning how to make the sauce. I've never made the sauce for anybody." What did she just tell you?
To me, she's saying that she's going to be making the spaghetti gravy. She's going to be making sauce. I don't know where your mind is going.
Is that a big deal or not a big deal to an Italian girl?
That's a huge deal. That's a huge deal that a woman would take the initiative and make an attempt to live up to your Italian mother's sauce. That's huge.
Okay.
That's huge. That's love.
Is it? What happens if you don't recognize it as such? Is that a bad thing?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
That's what
it would be like. It would be like when you had me over your house and you cooked that steak for me and
yeah.
I spit it out on my plate.
Oh, not come on! I didn't know I was culturally like ignorant. I just didn't know I had no idea what the significance of the sauce.
Did you do that?
Maybe.
Oh wow.
I didn't know. It was like, okay, I'm going to watch the 49ers. What? Yeah.
Not good. Not good, Major Mac.
But I didn't know. I didn't know, like, the sauce was, like, something special. Do you know what I mean? I didn't know. If I'd have known the sauce was, like, that's like nesting, right? If I'm making you the sauce, guess what, man?
You were the same one that called me up on Valentine's Day and asked me, "What should I do?" I can't give you a
chance. I was not. You can't get me out of that one? Yeah, you're right.
No,
let me just tell you. And then when she snapped, right, I was like, "What in the world? Like over sauce?" And she was like, "Yes, over sauce. Don't you?" No.
Yeah.
Who knew? Who knew sauce was that important?
Very important, especially with the Italian culture.
Right? I got an email, I'll read it to you, and I'm curious to hear what you say. This obviously, he says, "Mac, first of all, I'm Italian. When the girls with frizzy hair, with big asses, when they make the sauce, okay, you better be looking at rings, okay, because it just got serious. You, in your infinite stupid Anglo ways, had no idea. That's not an excuse, though, okay? And if she hit you in the head with the pan or physically assaulted you, she would be well within her rights as a frizzy-haired girl, okay?
It's a very personal thing for someone to make me anything.
Let alone sauce, right?
Yeah, let alone sauce.
Let alone
make
sauce.
Me anything.
Wow. Anyway, I didn't know. It was certainly not a good. It still is not even a good point.
Get back online and find another girlfriend.
All right. There you go. All right. Let's talk about you. First of all, we've got to do a little thumbnail bio for people that don't know you. Rich Caruso, born where?
Hornell, New York, upstate New York.
Okay. You joined the Marine Corps. Why?
I wanted to be a police officer, and in the state of New York, you can be a police officer until you were 21 years old, and I wanted to go in the Marine Corps, and I was a military policeman at 19.
Okay, so you're an MP. You're going to be a cop. Why the Marine Corps? Why not join the Air Force? Certainly an easier path to that profession, and you can still get there. So why the Marine Corps? How did that happen?
I had chances to go to play basketball at college, and my father, big Italian guy, comes from a big Italian family. His brother was a Marine in Guadalcanal, and I mean, he was like very respectful and everything to the Marine Corps. And one day, me and my father got in an argument, and to piss him off, I said, "Well, I'm going to go down and sign up for the Marine Corps." And he just looked at me like, "Okay, big stuff." And I went down there and took the ASVAB and got the delayed entry program and signed up and totally forgot about the whole thing. And then when I graduated high school, I was up in my room. I told this story before. I was up in my room in my underwear watching Gilligan's Island, and all of a sudden I heard a knock on the bedroom door. And I opened the bedroom door, and it's the Marine Corps recruiter saying, "Let's go. You're going to Paris Island." I'm like, "Listen, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to college." And he looked at me and he goes, "Oh, you signed up. You got to go." I said, "I don't care if I said no. I'm not going." And my father was at the bottom of the stairs, and he said, "Hey, big stuff." He goes, "You signed that paper." He goes, "Your word is your word." And I said, he goes, "If you don't go, you're a coward." And I'm like, "You just call me a coward, Dad?" And I put my shorts on, and they put me on a Greyhound bus to Buffalo, Mets. And I'm standing in Buffalo, Mets. I'm looking around saying, "What the hell am I doing here?" I had no intentions of going in the Marines. And then once I got that one, I was in third phase at Paris Island, and we were about to graduate, and we were marching back from the chow hall, and we came around the corner there, 2nd Battalion, right there by the Iwo Jima Monument on Paris Island, and the drill instructor ordered us to halt as a platoon. As I looked up, I seen a big white Buick Electra coming down Boulevard de France, right towards us, right by the Iwo Jima Monument. I knew it was my father's car. He drove all the way from New York to come see me graduate, and he pulls right up next to the platoon, gets out, got a big black trench coat on with a cigar, and he walks right up through the platoon, and he grabs me by the cheeks with tears in his eyes, and he kisses me on my cheek, and he goes, "I'm so proud of you." And he looks at the drill instructor, and he goes, "Thank you so much." And the drill instructor just nodded at him. And it's probably the most proudest day of my life.
The become a man in your dad's eyes, that's a big deal. Prove yourself.
Yeah.
Especially to Italians, because they've got all these crazy cultural customs that the rest of us don't understand.
Right.
like sauce. So you do your time in the Marine Corps, and you get out and you go to work in the California prison system. How long do you Okay, go ahead.
I got out of the Marine Corps, and I was in Yuma, Arizona, and I was the death sergeant in at PMO, and I was typing the daily blotter, which you know is the activities of all the battalions or whatever. Right. The arrests that we make.
Right.
And this guy walks up to the desk in Yuma, and he goes, "Excuse me, I'm down here on a coaching visit at one of the community colleges, and I used to be a Marine, and is there any way that I could, tour the base?" And in the back of my mind, I say, here we go. Used to be a Marine. Who is this guy? And he looks at me and he goes, he looked at my name tag and he goes, Richie Caruso? And I was like, wow. I go, Mike? And it was a friend of mine that I grew up with in Hornell, New York, named Mike Waffle, who is now the defensive line coach for the Buffalo Bills. And he was the defensive line coach for Fresno State. And that evening we went out, and he said, Richie, he goes, you get out in 3 weeks, pack a U-Haul up, put everything in a U-Haul, come to Fresno, California, and I'll get you a hotel, a condo. We'll get you set up with a savings account, and we'll bring you into camp. And he had everything laid out for me to earn a scholarship to play football at Fresno State. And I was like, I was all excited. And when I got out, as I was going out the main gate of Yuma, I gave the finger to the MPs and I said, I'm out of here. And I started heading up to Fresno, California in my U-Haul. And I pull into Fresno into a mall parking lot. And I call Mike at his house. And I said, Mike, I'm here. He goes, all right, come over to my house. So I went over to his house. And he took me and he introduced me to two other football players. One is the defensive line coach for the Raiders. His name is Jethro Franklin. And he got us a condo. So all three of us were living in this condo. And then he got us a job making soda machines at this Pepsi plant in Fresno, California. So as we're three football players on the assembly line making Pepsi machines, and then when we get off work, we work our ass off all day. When we get off work, we got to go train, and we got to go lift weights, and we got to go run. And everything is in place for me to achieve at Fresno State and earn a scholarship. So my friend Jethro Franklin, he's about to turn 20. And I took him out one night, and we were in Carl's Jr. having a hamburger. And I see this black BMW coming through the drive-thru convertible with this girl in it. And it looked like Kelly McGillis from Top Gun. And me and Jethro looked at her. I go, Jethro, I'm going to date that girl. And I went over there. I said, hey, I'm a football player, Fresno State. I gave her the old line and gave her my number. And Jethro said, she's never going to call you. Well, the next day my phone rang and it was her. And we connected. And long story short, I ended up giving the opportunity to play at Fresno State because I was in a relationship with a girl in Fresno, California. Then I went back to Steuben County in New York State and worked in the county jail as a sheriff. And I tested with the Department of Corrections in California before I left. So I was working in the jail in Steuben County, Bath, New York, and then California called me to come out and work in the California Department of Corrections in 1987.
Okay. All right. So you worked there until when?
With the California Department of Corrections?
Yes.
I retired out of there in 2001.
Okay. At what point?
Three different prisons.
At what point do you become a whistleblower?
Well, I mean,
what year?
There's the thing. Whistleblower is, to me, you've seen the movie Platoon.
Yes.
And in the Marine Corps, that you don't turn against your men, you don't turn against your fellow Marines. But like in the movie Platoon, when they went into that ville and they had those kids and those women and they were going to light them up and they were going to kill them, and the other guy in the Army came up and stopped it, that's basically kind of what happened with me. Was I worked at the deadliest prison in California, which was Corcoran State Prison right outside of Fresno. We had 6,000 inmates at this prison. And during the 80s, it was a prison boom. And what was happening was they emptied out the segregation units from San Quentin, Folsom, and Tehachapi, and they brought them all down to Corcoran. And we had 20 yards the size of handball courts. And they started mixing these inmates up and putting them out there with enemies. And lots of times they had to shoot them. And, I mean, these inmates go out there with nothing but their underwear. They don't have weapons. They don't even have tape in their cells. It's maximum security. So the fights were beginning to be predictable, and people were dying, and I found out about an inmate that got shot, an African-American that got shot, and I took it to my supervisor, who was a Marine, And it was, you know, I'm no bleeding heart. I believe an eye for an eye, and I'm tough on crime. But, you know, goddammit, I'm not going to put you out there and take your life just for disrespect or just for entertainment.
So what you're alluding to is people that had been somehow or other wronged a guard or whatnot, and they were being set up, and there would be retribution in some way, shape, or form. Yes.
Well, I mean, it could be something as little as disrespect, where you know the guard is feeding the inmates on the tier in the morning, and one of the inmates might complain that his oatmeal is cold. And the guard keeps moving down the tier, and the inmate yells, "Hey, didn't you hear me? My oatmeal's cold." And the guard's just ignoring him, and then the inmate's like, "F you," and the guard say, "What did you say?" And then that afternoon, that inmate goes out on that yard, and one of his enemies is coming out that door, and that guard is up there and going to shoot that inmate for just that disrespect. So people were playing God, and I was not going to be a part of that. And what I did is I went to my people first. I went to my chain of command first to stop the killings that were happening at Corcoran Prison. I didn't go outside the agency. I handled it within the chain of command because that's what a Marine does.
Right.
And they didn't want to hear about it. California correctional officers at the time were the highest paid law enforcement agency in the state of California at the time. We were making six figures. That's with overtime in the late 80s, early 90s.
Wow.
And that was big money out there for someone that just had 6 weeks of training. And it was a prison boom. And so basically I was going to kill someone, Mac, and get away with it and then have to live with it. And I had no problem killing an inmate if they had it coming and I was protecting them from assaulting another inmate. But I was not about to take another man's life just over peer pressure. It wasn't going to happen. And I stood up and I stopped it. After I went to my people up my chain of command, I was basically told just to shut up. Don't worry about it. We were the deadliest prison in the United States. We had more violence at our prison than all the nation's prisons put together. Body bags being carried out of that prison. So when I was told just to don't worry about it, myself and my lieutenant, who was a Marine, we contacted the FBI, and I started stealing stuff out of that prison, evidence for the FBI, to stop the violence at Corcoran.
All right, so that's how you become, that's the story of how you become a whistleblower.
Right.
Okay. All right, now, I want to switch gears, though. So for those of you who've never met Rich, now you have a story. I want to tell a story about your experience in the entertainment business. Cause it's Friday, so we kind of like to talk about more fun things and sober things today. So, first of all, what's the first inkling you get about this being something that somebody in the entertainment business might look at and say, "Hey, maybe we should do something with that"? What happens?
Well, I mean, my story was very high profile.
Right.
And I had to testify in front of the California Senate. It changed the whole system in the state of California. It changed the hiring practices. It changed the background investigations. It changed the shooting policy. As a result of my case out there in California, that changed the system for the better. I was on 60 Minutes twice. I was on A&E, so it became very high profile. So what happens in Hollywood is that Hollywood is run by like 30-year-olds who don't have the authenticity to sit down, they can't sit down and write a script, you know, make a good script. So they go into the LA Times or they go into the media and they get true stories, or you see a lot of animation voiceovers. You don't see that many movies that you walk out of there and say, "God, that was a great movie." Like the movie Fences that is out right now with Denzel. Great movie. And great writers. But so all of a sudden I started getting contacted by producers in Hollywood, and I had to get an agent, and I got an agent. And basically Paramount Pictures approached me, and they bought my rights for 2 years. They optioned them for 2 years, and they did nothing with my rights. They bought them for nobody else could have them, and they put me on a shelf. And after that,
And this is based on the news stories they had seen and the coverage they had seen of you nationally and your life story. They buy the rights to put it on a shelf and then do nothing with for 2 years.
Well, basically, yeah,
okay.
Correct. But they don't tell you they're going to put it on the shelf. They're,
right.
Telling you that they're going to make.
They're going to make something. Okay.
Right. And then they also tell you that, Richard, we don't need you. We don't need to buy your rights because you're in the national media, and we could just say, based on a true story, but we want you to be part of this. So, of course, you know, I wanted to be part of it. And so Paramount Pictures shelved my story. You know, I didn't know they were going to do that. But after 2 years, I got my rights back. And then Universal Studios bought my rights. And a guy by the name of Casey Silver. And Casey Silver had a discretionary fund from Universal Studios and bought my rights, and they assigned a writer by the name of David Chisholm. They gave him some big money to write a script. David came and stayed with me in Napa, California, and he wrote a script for Universal Studios. And I had never been to that point to where, oh, my God, this movie might get made. Well, then 9/11 happened, and instead of Casey Silver making my movie, Casey made Geely with J-Lo and Ben Affleck, and it bombed. And he made a movie called Ladder 49. So then I got my rights back again.
Okay.
And Michael Jackson was on trial in Los Angeles for child molestation, and I was in Myrtle Beach. And there was a show on MSNBC called The Dan Abrams Report.
Right.
And when the jury was out on Michael in the state of California, they have one unit that handles high-profile inmates. And, you know, in there you have Sirhan Sirhan, Juan Corona, Phil Spector, Charles Manson, and that was one of the units that I worked. So I was being interviewed on that show, Dan Abrams, at the Michael Jackson trial, and a director in Hollywood recognized me and said, "That's Richard Caruso from 60 Minutes." Got a hold of MSNBC. MSNBC got a hold of me and said, "There's a director from Hollywood that would like to call you." Within 2 days, the director was on a plane and flew to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. He bought my rights. He optioned them for 2 years. We were on the bed in a hotel room in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, writing on index cards a storyline to a movie that we didn't have a name. And after that, he flew back to Hollywood, and probably 4 or 5 times a week at nighttime, we would talk for an hour or two at night, and we started putting the storyline together. And then finally, about a year into the process, he came up with the movie Felon. I didn't like it, but he came up with it. And within 2 years, I was on a movie set in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at the Old State Prison. We bought the Old State Prison for 3 months, the longest yard just to film. And then we got it after them, and we made the movie Felon based on my life story.
All right. I want to talk about making that movie. I want to talk about your experience in the entertainment business, because there's a, you know, certainly much interest. There's a lot of Marines that are interested in the entertainment business. When you're approached by Marines about that business and getting into it, do you give them any general advice?
Basically, you know, first I want to hear their story, and you know, if they have a story that has a catch, and you definitely need an agent, you know, and basically, what that agent will do is put a short synopsis to the story, and basically have you come out to Hollywood or whatever, and you'll go around to the major studios, and you'll do what's called the dog and pony show. You'll get 15 minutes, in front of these studio executives. You know, I've been to every studio out in Hollywood, Universal, Disney, all of them. And basically the studio execs, you know, will either want to buy your rights or pass. And I mean, it's very cutthroat, but you're not going to be able to do it without getting an agent. And at the time, you know, it's like Black Hawk Down and a lot of these other movies, they contact you, you know, to go and search and try to say, I got this story, I want to write this book, or, you know, a lot of people want you to put the money up front. When you got something that's current or you got a good story, you know, the agent that represents you, he'll take his money on the ass end. So basically, you know, he's out there hustling for you and he's selling your story. These people that want the money up front, you know, they're going to sometimes, you know, they'll take $5,000-$10,000 of, you know, these people's money and, you know, the book will never get written or the movie will never get made. You know, that poor individual standing there with his hand saying, you know, you promised me. And they look at him and say, no, we didn't promise you anything. So if they ended up getting approached by an agent and they have a story that, you know, is worth, you know, writing a book or making a movie, my advice is to make sure that agent takes the percentage on the ass end of the deal, because you don't want to pay somebody, you know, they're stealing money from you. Getting a movie made is very rare. I don't know what the percentage is as far as many people get their rights, you know, purchased. But to go through the process, like I said, it took me 3 hits. To go through the process and actually get it made, it's hard. And I was with some very heavies out there in Hollywood. Harry Ufflin, Paul Pompeian. I know some people out there that they've made movies, but it was all about the studios and, you know, putting up millions of dollars to get that movie made. You know, all the stars have to align, Mac, and it's just like any business, any pro team. You know, who's this one know? You know, the nepotism, and if they, you know, have they made movies before? Have they been there and done that? If we give you $5 million, what have you done? You know, what have you done? And I mean, it's very cutthroat. And but I was very fortunate. Felon cost a little over $3 million, and Sony Pictures put the money up. We had A-list actors. We had Val Kilmer, Sam Shepard, Ann Archer, Stephen Dorff.
Wow.
So I mean, we had actors that, you know, that came in there and basically embraced me and said, Richard, we love your story and we want to make this movie. They weren't there for money, believe me. The guy that plays me in Felon, Nate Parker, the African American, we were giving him $500 a day to play me in Felon as an extra. He was writing at the time and he's saying, Rich, you know, I'm writing these scripts. And I'm like, well, you know, stay with it, Nate. You never know. He was in the movie called Story About Bees. He was in Red Tails. He was in a movie called Pride. And just 3 years ago at Sundance Film Festival, he sold a script for $43 million. And 3 months ago, his movie came out in the theaters called Birth of a Nation.
Wow.
That's Nate Parker played me in Felon. I knew Nate when he was just coming out of Penn State. He was involved in a sexual assault up in Penn State, and he was just looking for work. And now, you know, he's making $43 million selling a script in Hollywood, you know. But he had done movies with Oprah and Denzel, so he was connected. I mean, it's all about who you get connected with.
My guest this morning is a former Marine MP. He got out as a corporal, Rich Caruso, and we're talking about the movie that was based on his life and his experience in the California prison system and his kind of trip through the entertainment business. So far we've learned it's a cutthroat business and you need an agent, all right? Talk to us about making the movie itself. So it sounds like phase one is do the basics, which is get your agent. Phase two is hope your agent sells it and takes it on the back end. Now phase three is making it. So you report to the set and you're going to be a technical advisor. What are you going to be in the production?
Well, phase three was, you know, me on the phone 3-4 nights a week with the director for a year, educating him about Corcoran, educating him about gangs, educating him about prison, just educating him and coming up with storylines. For example, the lead character in Felon, something happens in the house, and he ends up going to Corcoran for 3 years. and the director was asking me, Rich, how do we get him, a guy that's never been in trouble before, on that bus, but he ends up in maximum security? So I come up with a storyline saying, well, listen, this is how we'll do it. He'll be on the bus. An incident will happen on the bus. He witnesses it, but he doesn't want to snitch. So I had to come up with all of that. You know what I'm saying? Because they don't know. Right. It would be like you telling me a story about Afghanistan or Iraq that you were involved in, but I got to learn how it was to be there. Right. You understand what I'm saying?
I'm with you. I'm with you. So that goes on for what? So developing the storylines and the different scenes to the movie.
Right, and the character, and the characters. We had to develop the characters, the storyline. And then basically that went out for about a year and a half. And then he called me and he said, hey, we're hiring talent. And the person that was going to be in Felon was, who was the young man that died in the Ferrari that was in Fast and the Furious?
Hold on, give me one second.
Can't think of his name.
Right.
He was going to be the lead in Felon, but he was busy. So then Stephen Dorff from Blade, we hired him. So he started telling me, you know, who the talent was, Val Kilmer, Sam Shepard, Ann Archer. And he goes, you know, I'm flying you out. You know, you're going to have to be out here for 8 weeks in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I said, well, let's do it. And we flew out there, and for 8 weeks every day.
Paul Walker.
You know, you show,
Paul Walker or Vin Diesel?
Paul Walker. Yes, okay. Paul Walker.
All right.
And so, you know, every day you show up on the set, you got a shooting schedule. Everything is laid out, time frames. Everything is, you know, at 8:30 we're shooting this scene. At 9:30 we're shooting that scene. You know, everything is laid out for the whole 8 weeks is laid out. And everyone has to be in a certain place at a certain time. It's very structured. And, you know, then you got the actors that come in, the ones that come in humble, and then the ones that got egos, and you have to manage their egos, and you got directors that are stroking some of their egos, and, you know, me, you know, I didn't stroke anyone's ego. The movie was about my life, so it was like, you know, I'm impressed that you're an actor, but really, you know, that's all you are to me is an actor. My heroes are the people that put on uniforms every day, law enforcement and first responders and military, you know, those are my heroes. So, so then we started shooting Felon, and it took us probably 7 weeks to shoot it. Then it goes to editing.
Right.
And editing took about 7.5 months. But what happened with Felon was when Sony agreed to give the money, it was already determined it was going to go straight to DVD. So when we made the movie, they were like, hey, we got something here. And they put it in front of a focus group, and a focus group was like, that's a good movie. And so Sony was getting positive feedback on it. This is a good movie. And so it came out in like 6 or 10 theaters across the United States, but it kind of screwed us because they had already determined. They didn't allocate the money to put it out in the theaters. And so, you know, I mean, if you Google top 10 prison movies of all time, I mean, Felon is in there. And so I'm proud, you know.
And it never, and it was never released in the theater in spite of?
10 theaters. L.A., it came out in L.A. It came out in New York. And it came out in, I think, Miami. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't saturated all throughout the United States because they didn't allocate the money in the beginning for it to happen.
Right.
But once the movie was made and Sony seen the product, they were like, shit, you know? So, I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of things that have to fall in place to, get, you know, to get a movie made. And like I said, the whole thing is being with a team that has been there and done that. You could be a damn ball boy on the damn New England Patriots, and you're probably going to get a Super Bowl ring in 5 years. You know what I mean?
Right.
Be on a team that's been there and done that, and you'll probably get the movie made. But, you know, it's all about who you know, who's the director know, who's worked with who. And, you know, I was with big dogs. I was big with big fish, and I was just a little guppy. And but the story was about the little guppy. So I kind of just sat back with a smirk, and you know, they all had their egos fed, and I was just the guy that the story was about. I was a producer. I acted in the movie. It was a great process. I met a lot of great people, but the business is very cutthroat, you know, and I don't like living in that world of cutthroat. I like living in the world of, you know, being around my military people and being around my first responders and being around my gym rats. That's the world that I excel in.
That's your world. All right. Richard Caruso is our guest. He is a former MP, United States Marine Corps. He is a worked in the California prison system as a guard. He after trying to reform it from the inside, became a whistleblower, put his hand up and told the truth, which led to significant reform of that system. The movie is called Felon, and we're talking about his kind of journey to make that movie and its impact on his life. We're going to talk about its impact on his life and the different things that came out of the movie after this break. So, Richard, you sit tight. I know you're kind of an antsy guy, but do me a favor, sit tight. And we'll be back. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you, and we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
Henry Sar, Gnarly Army here with important information for veterans. At 2,600 American job centers nationwide, veteran and transitioning military personnel can find help with career counseling, resumes, and job placement. You want more information, don't you? The Department of Labor offers a variety of programs to help our military heroes find good jobs or continue their education. What are you waiting for?
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. ...8:49 here on a Friday. Richard Caruso's story is a pretty interesting one, and we've been talking about it this morning. in a lot of different ways. One simply being a whistleblower is not your basic trip down memory lane for a lot of people. And then to take that story and have it blow up. I'm curious, Richard. Tell me about the fallout. The movie gets made. You know, I'm sure people watch it, are moved by it, see their own life experience in it. What are some of the things that happened, you know, post-release of the movie that impacted you?
I mean, the fallout of coming forward and doing the right thing and basically stepping up and holding a huge department like the Department of Corrections accountable came from 1994 to 2001, so 7 years of my life out in California walking. You know, I was walking in that prison every day, and those officers that were involved and knew who I was that were involved in that FBI investigation, I mean, they put out a hit on me to be killed. And the Mexican Mafia, the Aryan Brotherhood, the Black Guerrilla Family, the Texas Syndicate, you had prison gangs in that prison that couldn't believe that a cop stood up to stop the violence and the killings. And they put a protective circle around me and let me exist within that environment. And the good cops, you know, they were like, hey, you know, this is going to tarnish all of us. You know, these bad apples need to go. And, you know, the 98% of the good officers, they didn't want to come out and exposed the misconduct because everything was being funded by the California Department of Correction, their house payments, their boat payments, you know, all their, you know, everything, their lifestyle is being funded. So they didn't want to take the step that I did to come out and expose the wrongs of the department. But they a lot of them didn't agree with what was going on, you know. The reason that I came forward wasn't so much, you know, I'm not trying to get on my soapbox and be, right, you know, I was this choir boy, but I was going to kill somebody and get away with it. I was getting ready to be promoted to a sergeant. I was part of that inner circle, and I 100% was expected to kill somebody and 100% was going to get away with it. And I couldn't have that on my conscience going through life. And when I came to that fork in the road, after being an MP in the Marine Corps, after being a cop my whole life, I knew once I went down this road, all that was going to be gone. There was no talks of movies. There was no talks of money. I knew once I go down this road, I'm going to have nothing. So that was 1994. The movie didn't come about until 2007. So, wow. For 7 years, you know, I mean, I was living on credit cards. The state was starving me out. The heads of the Department of Corrections were in the media saying, don't trust him. He can't be trusted. What he's saying is a lie. And then, the FBI and, federal investigators went in there and they tore the prison up and millions and millions of dollars in investigations happened and proved to what I was saying and what, my lieutenant, who's a Marine, was saying was true. And, it reformed the whole system out there. If you're interested in watching Felon, I would read the true story first and just Google my name, Richard Caruso, Corcoran Prison, and then you'll have the base of what the movie is about. But, you know, it wasn't all, you know, trust me, Mac, I had a full head of hair in 1994. And, I mean, there was a lot of stress and there was a lot, I was putting my life on the line daily in that environment. I didn't know if it was going to be my last day at work. And, fortunately, the good officers, the good staff, the good people in the public. I mean, I was very jaded being in prison every day because, you know, anyone that came up to me in public, I always thought, well, they have an agenda. You know, what do they want from me? And I realized that, you know, there's a lot of good people out there. There's a lot of good people out there, and the public embraced me. And they said, you know, it's not so much that we feel sorry for inmates, but to play judge, jury, and executioner over something that's not warranted is wrong. And what separates you as an officer from that inmate if you're doing that? And I got a lot of support from the public, and that gave me strength. Otherwise, mentally, especially as a Marine, you know, I wouldn't have been able to get through it without that kind of support.
All right, I've got a couple email. I want to get to you. Hey Mac, what an incredible story. The part I find most incredible is hearing him in the last few minutes talk about the flash to bang, the lonely nights, being scared, knowing there's maybe a contract out on your life, not knowing how your life is going to wind up, and being really cut loose by an institution that you cared about probably more than a lot of people that stayed in it. So hats off to him. Has he ever had any other inkling to do anything else in the entertainment business? So Richard, I mean, you go through that process, and you said you made a lot of friends there. Certainly, we're not from the same tribe. It's certainly a different tribe that they grow up in. But no matter who you cross paths with in life, you have things in common. Have you ever contemplated doing anything else in the entertainment business?
I have. They're talking about Felon 2 when they made the movie Snitch with The Rock. A lot of the stuff that the discovery that we did on Felon was used in making that movie. I'm not out there hitting the path. As you know, I just went and supported Larry Hinkle going across country. That's an amazing story that I would love to see brought into a book or a movie. There's a lot of military people out there and a lot of first responders that have amazing stories. And,
right.
I mean, I like acting like the bridge now and try to put them in the appropriate hands. My agent has, passed away. And, but some of the people that I know in Hollywood or whatever, you know, they give it the sniff test. And if they like it, you know, they give it to the next guy. And if they don't like it, they pass on it. So, you know, I mean, it's all about who you align yourself with. But as far as my future in the entertainment business, my future is standing up for veterans. My future is working with veterans. My future is at the homeless shelters on that soup line. I'm not on a soapbox to say, look at me, look at me. I did some great stuff, stuff that other people didn't do. I stood out there and made a change. But my love is being out there and shaking the hands and hugging the necks of first responders and veterans. That's my calling, not the entertainment business.
Got it. Any other advice that I haven't been smart enough to ask? Because, you know, you're right. There are a lot of different stories that are out there that are very, very compelling from Iraq to Afghanistan to, you know, from Vietnam that the guys roll around with, and you see Marines. Ken Rogers comes to mind. All he wanted to do was tell the story of his company at Kaesan, and he made just an incredible documentary that has opened up another career path for him. Any advice that you'd like to give that I'm not smart enough to ask you the right question about?
Don't say the sauce is bad.
Hey, that's a few years late, bro. Where the hell were you when I needed you? When the girls with frizzy hairs that have big asses, when they learn to make the sauce, you better get correct, man. You better get correct. If somebody would have told me that, I would have been, uh-oh, she's gonna make the sauce, man. This is like, I got to get correct here. Let me put on some nicer clothes, and I gotta know what I'm doing.
You'll be all right.
Yeah.
You'll be all right, Matt. it's just aligning. It's getting a good agent. It's like with Larry Hinkle's story. You know, we've had people approach us that want money up front, and I'm like, Larry, I go, they're just going to take your money. And if they see value in your story,
right,
they'll take the money on the ass end. And they'll take 15% their percentage, and they'll get out there and they'll work for you. There's people out there that will take your money and rob you. And you just got to have to align yourself with people that are, you know, have been there, done that. And I guess if I had any advice for anybody that wanted to sell their stories or sell their rights, do not, listen to me, do not give money up front. make that agent or make that person that represents you take the money on the ass end.
Got it. Got it. Got it. All right. Overall, good experience or bad experience for you?
A lot of it, I mean, it was a growing experience. You know, a lot of it was bad. A lot of it was good. Money brings out all kinds of people into your life that, you know, I haven't changed, but the people around me that have changed. A lot of people around me have changed. I've seen, you know, I think money is evil. And, you know, even if you want to do the right thing, people come into your life with agendas now and, you know, they don't have a genuine agenda to come into your life as a Marine brother that's sitting there hugging on you because you're a Marine and that's your brother. He doesn't care what you got in your pocket, whether you got 10 cents in your pocket. He's loving on you because you're a Marine. They come into your life because they want to get in that pocket because they heard you got money. And unfortunately, that has left a sour taste in my mouth to where, you know, I'm more comfortable being around my Marine brothers and my veterans than I am around the haves of the world, the people that are the haves. I'm nothing but a have-not, Mac. I'm a have-not. I'm a Marine. I'm a gym rat. I love my military family. I love my first responders, and that's just who I am.
Got it. All right, man. First of all, I want to thank you for doing this. Always interesting. About the entertainment business and how different people get involved in it. And your story is an incredible one. Absolutely incredible. And, you know, the thing I love about it is that there's kind of a theme. Richard Caruso, if you don't know him, he's about 8 years old, right? In terms of his view of respect, that was killed by his family had never changed. When his dad told him, when the recruiter comes and says, you signed up, and he looks at him and says, hey, you gave your word. And he has this, this beautiful look in terms of respect and admiration for things that are beautiful. And those things that are beautiful in our tribe are your word, respect, discipline, hard work. And that's why our tribe is so different. You know, and I crossed paths with him because of the things that he was doing on Facebook, and a mutual friend, put us in touch, and I wound up making him dinner on election night. But your life is a good life because of the good things that you stood up for. And I think it's a great story, for a lot of people about, hey, you know, do the right thing and Things tend to take care of themselves. It's certainly not the easiest path.
I appreciate that.
But you have a simplicity. You have a simplicity about the way you look at your life, and that I think that has allowed you to be vindicated in certain parts of your life, and to live a good life. And the camaraderie you continue to share with Marines, and with first responders, and the inspiration you provide, the encouragement you provide. Is needed by a lot of people, but it's a simple life philosophy about do the right thing that was given to him by his parents, that was shined in the Marine Corps, that was tested in the California prison system, and Richard Caruso, kind of like a ship cutting through the sea that doesn't waver a whole lot. And so it's very cool to have you on to tell your story. And, cause I know there's a lot of Marines out there that do have stories and wonder, well, geez, would anybody be interested? And it's great to be able to bring somebody like you on, Richard, to tell your story and to be an asset maybe to those guys who are looking for some kind of guidance. But,
Mac, before I get off, I know you're running short on time. I, you know, the way you just summed it up, I mean, the people that have come into my life, I mean, you see my Facebook, people like Wayne Miller, Larkin Spivey, a great author here in the South, a great military writer. You know, I meet these guys on my journey, you know, when I'm on the road and I'm shaking hands and, you know, you're out there and you see that vet with the hat and you sit there and you talk to them and they got a story and all of a sudden this guy was in World War II and you're sitting there and you're just amazed by these stories. And I mean, I met Wayne Miller. He's the head of Marines of New York, and the stuff that he's doing in New York and the stuff he did for the the Corporal Dunham memorial that we're going to do up there in May 29th. I mean, these are special people. And this is the reward of just doing the right thing in life. It's karma, Mac. It's karma. If you do good, it will come back to you tenfold. And I'm not trying to say I'm a choir boy or, you know, but I do try to live a good life. I try to do what's right. I'm not out there breaking the law. I'm not out there doing drugs. I'm not out there, you know, I'm out there giving back to veterans and giving back to first responders, going to the gym and loving on our guys. And that's just who I am.
All right, man. Well, first of all, what do you got in store this weekend? Anything exciting?
Nothing exciting. It's about 70. It's sunshine here in Myrtle Beach. I'm just blessed. I worked out early so I could do your show. And, you know, I get up and I'm like, oh my God, it's 5 o'clock. I got to be in the gym by 6:30. Mac's going to call me at 11. And then I'm sitting there saying, what the hell am I bitching? People got to get up and go to work to pay their electric bill. And here I'm bitching about doing a radio show. So I catch myself every day and I got to humble myself to reality of that. I'm very blessed. I'm blessed with the people in my life. If you could have seen the Facebook post on my Facebook yesterday from the citizens of Scio, New York, they had over 1,000 shares on that one Facebook post about Corporal Dunham and us coming up there and dedicating the sign and doing the memorial parade, Mac. There's only 1,900 people in this town, and over 1,000 of them shared that story. There was an 82. I had a reporter call me from Cuba, New York last night, and she was interviewing me, and she said, Richard, I got an 82-year-old neighbor that came walking out of his house this morning and said, I read Richard Caruso's post about Corporal Dunham over in that town, Scio, and goddamn it, I'm going to that parade. Now, that kind of stuff, Mac, is what gives me, you know, gets me all juiced up is doing stuff like that.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you. I told you, but after Corporal Dunham shielded his fellow Marines from a grenade, when I was working for General Mattis in 2004, I wound up with this helmet that he used.
You had Corporal Dunham's helmet?
I had Corporal Dunham's helmet. If you can imagine. So his regimental commander shows up one day to see General Mattis, Craig Tucker, and he has a box, and he hands it to me. He goes, hey, Mac, hold on to this. He gave it to General Mattis. General Mattis walks out, and he goes, hey, Mac, hold on to this. Put it someplace. And I said, Roger, sir. So I locked it up, and people found out that I had seen that I had it. And it was almost like it became a sacred thing. It was a sacred thing. I'd have guys come back and say, hey, Mac, what's up? And I'd say nothing. And then I'd kind of look up and like, can I help you? And like, hey, I heard you have Corporal Dunham's helmet. Could I see it? And and if I liked him, I'd show it to him. If I didn't like him, I'd say, no, I can't show it to you. I was sure. It was a Kevlar helmet, and the piece that...
Do you know the cover of that Kevlar helmet is in the mast of the battleship that's named after him?
I saw that. And it had been turned into kind of a Kevlar pom-pom. Our helmets are this pressed, you know, they're strips of Kevlar, and then it's heated and compressed, and that's what gives it its strength. And the explosion it literally looked like a girl's pom pom as these strips of Kevlar had been detonated. And no, you just looked at it, you saw the sacrifice, and I read the narrative because they had submitted the Medal of Honor for him. But there were no eyewitness accounts, and in the submission they talked about them arguing about this in the squad bay. Them saying, no, I think the helmet could contain the blast, and if you shielded it with your chest,
that was his belief.
The combination, if you read the submission of the guys in his squad about them arguing about it, they said they knew exactly what happened because it came back to us. It came back to us as a Bronze Star with a V because there were no eyewitnesses, and then it had to go to the Secretary of the Navy.
I didn't know you were that close to the story.
Oh, let me tell you, when it came back with a Bronze Star as a Bronze Star with a V, I can't tell you the anger in the 1st Marine Division. about that. And then it was like, hey, then, you know, somebody got on the phone, and actually the chief of staff of the division was Joe Dunford, who's now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I'll tell you what, and Colonel Dunford is awesome. And this is one of the moments that, you know, you learn what a great guy he is. He got on the phone with guys at CENTCOM, and he said, you know, what the fuck, over? And they said, hey, look, you have to have, the Medal of Honor requires two eyewitness accounts, okay? That's the requirement. We can't waive the requirement. So we have to downgrade it to something that doesn't require an eyewitness account, which is the Bronze Star, and we're forwarding it to the Secretary of the Navy with our recommendation that it be upgraded to the Medal of Honor. And then it was like, oh, okay. And so with that information, everybody's like, all right, now we just got to walk the dog on it, and they've got to do their due diligence. But it was a shrine. No, it was a shrine, and nobody that ever saw it will forget it, the courage and selflessness of a young American who could have kicked it, who could have turned his back and ran and still be alive today. But in a moment where there is only the quick and the dead, he made a decision to shield his fellow Marines and gave his life. So Corporal Jason Dunn.
I had no idea that you were that close to the story, but Mac, if you could have been around me yesterday, and all day long I'm getting messages from citizens up there in Scio, New York, saying, Richard, you know, I have Patriot riders that will line the path of the parade. Richard, I got access to the fire department's fire trucks, and we'll drape the American flag over the parade. Richard, I have access to a high school band that's 35 miles away, and we're going to come and march in the parade. But what was being confusing was they were thinking the parade is all about Corporal Dunham, and I had to be specific and say the parade is about all veterans that have served and that have passed and served. But we're going to make the memorial, the sign about Corporal Dunham. The state is going to dedicate the sign, and then we're going to lay a wreath at his grave. But just the outpouring from that community, Mac, was just unbelievable. It really touched me, and that's what I like to be around. I mean,
no, let me tell you, there's no greater inspiration in life than the courage and selflessness of veterans, of guys who've served, who've put something greater than themselves. It's the purpose of All Marine Radio. It's what has intoxicated Richard. It's what's intoxicated me, and what intoxicates most Marines as they go through life. It's what we're about, and we can't let it go for whatever reason, for good or bad.
If you give me a choice and say, well, Richard, you made a movie, you were in Hollywood, you were in the movie business, and if you said you had two rooms, Richard, in one room you had 200 World War II veterans in there sitting there just cutting up, in the other room you could go and be in the front row of the Oscars, Richard Caruso would go in that room with the World War II veterans.
Not even a choice, right?
Not even a choice.
Not even a choice. All right, man. Look, first of all, thank you for doing this, and have a great weekend. And I'm going to give you a call later on today because I have something to talk to you about. And all the best, man. Thank you.
All right. Love you, brother.
All right. There you have it. That is my Italian friend, Richard Caruso, here on a Friday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. We're going to take a quick break. When I come back, we're going to talk to the guy from Montana that we make fun of all the time. That's right. His name's Rob Schwarz. And we are also going to talk to Kurt Knowles, Rudy. He's the official F-18 explainer here on All Marine Radio. So both of those guys, great guys, battle buddies, will join us next on a Friday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Don't touch that dial.